Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. This is a joy and harkens back in his 20 years at Columbia to Lee Bollinger and myself in conversation at Davos, I'm going to say 2004, 2005, in his vision of a Columbia University that would support Harlem and support New York City with Manhattanville. That is now, and they have moved forward from Bollinger to the great architect Renzo Piano to Professor Cohen. Joining us now, Abby Joseph Cohen, of course, always with Goldman Sachs. No, former Goldman Sachs senior investment strategist and professor at Geffen 590 Columbus Business School. Abby, you are going to start your future of global economy course remote because of COVID, because of Omicron as well. When you get to Geffen 590, how will you lecture the business students? What will you bring to them different?
Well, Tom, first of all, thank you for inviting me to be here this morning. This, in fact, is the first time I've been speaking since my shift over from Goldman Sachs. I'm ecstatic about this change, moving to the Columbia Business School. And the Global Economics and Financial Markets course that I'll be teaching is actually a course I've been teaching for the past 8 or 9 years. I've been a longstanding adjunct at Columbia, and I consider it to be a great intellectual home. The course itself is a combination of theory and practice. I have the opportunity to teach with one of the wonderful tenured professors at Columbia, a gentleman by the name of Pierre Yared, who will be covering a lot of the theoretical macro, and I'll be talking about, well, what's really happened in the market. Not just over the last few days, but if you will, over the last several decades, trying to put this all in perspective for our students.
The perspective needed away from your prodigious math abilities is the new capitalism. Columbia Business School has supporters with names that we know on surveillance, Kravis, Cooperman, of course, the great gentleman from entertainment, David Geffen. How do the new capitalists and the budding MBA students, how do they deal with a new, more responsible capitalism?
Oh, that's a terrific question, Tom. And let's keep in mind that at Columbia, there's also this great legacy of intellectual capital. Some of the great thinkers in terms of capital markets in the 1930s and 40s also had relationships at Columbia, strong economics department, strong finance department, people like Ben Graham, for example. And so what I see in the new students is really quite interesting. At Columbia, about half of the students in my course are in fact non-Americans, and they bring an incredible global perspective to what we're seeing. You know, very often when we look at structural change in the United States, we say, oh, nobody else has ever dealt with this before. Well, we are actually incorporating the experiences of our students as well. We do find that this generation of students is very much interested in a few things. Number one, they'd like to know how companies run, obviously. In our course, we also talk about how government policy is made, and we give the students opportunities to debate what should those policies look like. And among the topics we addressed, of course, are things like ESG, but we also look at things like regulatory changes, things that might need to be adjusted as the structure of an economy changes. And of course, I always love to talk about the fundamentals, the data in the economy, but also the valuation of the markets. And when I say the markets, it's not just equity,
Lisa,
it's also fixed income.
Right. Lisa Bramitz, you know somebody in row 7 is going to stand up and say, hey, Abby, what do you think of the market? I mean, that's what this is going.
And so I'll do it. I'll stand up in row 36 and say, we just got this PPI data after yesterday's CPI data. We're now pricing in about 4 rate hikes. We're in a new regime for inflation. What's the market call at a time when most strategists are bullish on equities?
Yeah, I think, in fact, the regime change, Lisa, occurred a few months ago when we began to see data suggesting that inflation was rising, that interest rates would be moving up. And underneath the surface of the market indices, we have seen a great deal of action. Obviously, the rise in volatility, but we're also seeing that investors are starting to move away from the big mo. And that big mo for many years, of course, was fixed income, buy bonds, regardless of the interest rates. We see that investors are becoming much more selective in fixed income. And of course, we see that in equities as well. The thing that is always so important is what's already baked in to expectations. My feeling is that we have a few surprises ahead in the equity market, some good, some not so good. But the key for me is always the valuation support. And that valuation support is not particularly good in some segments of the market. In some, it looks pretty good. There are some growthy areas that are not yet priced excessively. But the overall market, I think, will be volatile because the only valuation metrics that still look appealing are the ones that are linked to low inflation, low interest rates. As those continue to move up somewhat in 2022, the equity market comes under some pressure. I think PE ratios for the overall market compress somewhat. I think there's some offset in terms of continued improvements in earnings growth, because I certainly don't see a recession. So I think the real action in the market is going to be under the surface, not so much in the indices.
And based on that, this idea of the action under the surface, how much of that is pricing in a perfect transition to a tightening cycle? This idea of an exit and threading a needle that by all accounts is going to be tough for the Fed to do.
Well, you raised two very interesting points. Number one, the needle that the Fed has to thread. And they'll be doing it through a combination, I believe, of increases in short rates, but also adjusting that balance sheet. Could there be another temper tantrum? Maybe, but I think the Fed is actually doing a great job by signaling these things ahead of time. You know, when I started as a junior economist at the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, the rule of thumb then was you didn't tell the markets anything about what you plan to do as policymakers. And 2 to 3 months later, you'd start to tell people what in fact had already happened. That's not the way it works now. I think the signaling that gets done by the Fed is actually very, very helpful in that regard. So that's one needle that has to be threaded. I think the Fed has begun to do a very good job. The other needle that has to be threaded is how to position portfolios. And I think that institutional investors have been talking about this. They haven't been doing it. I worry much more so about individual investors, many of whom haven't yet figured out the damage that could occur to their personal portfolios as interest rates begin to rise. And that to me is concerning. Right. And so when we think about, you know, shocks to the system when the valuation support's not so good, we can't assume a smooth transition. There are some risks out there that could knock us off balance. People talk always about the pandemic, which is not over. We need to worry about what's happening in other countries where vaccine distribution has been quite limited. We also need to worry about a disruption in fixed income markets and what that could do. And I know that there are some people out there who are concerned about what happens when people recognize that there's now been this big difference between cap market performance and equal weighted performance.
Abby, in the Geffen 590, when they ask you for your market call, just tell them yield up, price down, and leave it at that. Professor Cohen, thank you so much for joining us today with Columbia Business School. Let's get right to it. Lisa Shallet joins us, the Chief Investment Officer, Morgan Stanley Wealth Management. Lisa, I want to cut to the chase. How much cash do you need right now? Is cash a negative thing, or is cash in a portfolio a positive construct?
So we're looking at cash as an opportunistic asset right here. If you look underneath the surface of these indices, you know, you've got 85 to 90% of the stocks in the market have actually corrected from 52-week highs, and many have corrected as much as 10 or 20%. So we think that this is an opportunistic stock picker's market, but you have to do your homework. And that homework really requires understanding If you've got enough defensiveness in your names, if you've got quality, if you've got the potential to beat profit forecasts, if you've got the potential to raise dividends and do buybacks, because those are the types of things that are going to allow your stock to be resilient in against a tape where the Fed is raising rates and the cost of capital is drifting higher, which means price earnings ratios are drifting lower.
Lisa, this cycle has moved at a rapid pace. Is it too early still to say this is late cycle? It's a late cycle dynamic now?
I think it's a little early to say that. You know, we've been pretty consistent in saying that this is a mid-cycle transition. Certainly the labor market with unemployment below 4% is starting to feel late cycle to us. We are in the camp that says structural changes have happened in the labor market that are going to prevent participation rates from, you know, rapidly mean reverting to where we were pre-pandemic. But we do think that there's a big chunk of the economy that has yet to recover, and that's really the consumer services part of the economy. So we're still in that, you know, it's a late mid-cycle as opposed to explicitly late cycle.
Well, late mid-cycle at a time when the market is currently pricing in about 4 rate hikes in 2022. I keep asking investors, have equities fully priced this in yet? And frankly, the answer has come back, yeah, everybody knows it's priced in. Do you agree?
I don't. I think that the stock market has been extraordinarily skeptical of the Fed. I think that you know, when you have had as powerful a Fed put as we have had in this market, quite frankly, for the past 13 years, going all the way back to the great financial crisis in March of 2009, it's really hard to convince people that the regime is shifting. So we do think that certainly the indices, some of the more richly valued names that we all know, those Teflon mega cap tech names, still need to reprice a decent amount, maybe 10 to 15% to reflect what we do think is the distance forward on rates.
Lisa, you think that big tech still needs to correct 10 to 15% from here? Just to make that very clear, I have to think, what's the trigger given the fact that we just got CPI coming in at the hottest level in 39 years? We're about to get a similar read from PPI.
Yeah. Look, I think it's a question of actually seeing the Fed follow through. Certainly we've now planted the seeds that not only are rate hikes on the table and rate hikes on the table as early as March, but, you know, the Fed minutes really planted the seeds that perhaps we're going to see balance sheet runoff. Now, balance sheet runoff really contributes to actual tightening and really ultimately translates into the equivalent of additional rate hikes. So I think once there's more clarity on that, that'll be, quote unquote, the last down leg in the market among those names that, again, heretofore have proven kind of resilient and Teflon-like.
Lisa, 3 to 5 years out, how do you rationalize double-digit revenue growth at the technology profit makers? Not the ones where there's a story, but the ones that are minting free cash flow every day. How do you approach those with a longer-term time horizon?
Well, Tom, I love your question because this is the conversation we're having with clients every single day. What we're trying to get folks to understand is it's not a question of whether these are great companies. It's a question of whether they're great stocks and what's priced in and how realistic is it that some of the growth rates that we've seen, much of which have included a pull forward of demand because many of these themes were linked to work from home or were linked to some of the unique dimensions of this pandemic. Can you really make the case that those double digit type growth rates are going to sustain? And history is just not kind on this point. Innovation is terrific, but so is disruption. And it's very rare for companies decade after decade to be able to sustain these levels of growth without, quite frankly, being disrupted by competition.
Can they go, and we think, Yeah, this is really important. I wish we had an hour for this, but we've got such a great hour, Lisa, for you to start. Can they go Clay Christensen and bring the disruption inside?
Look, certainly they can, and perhaps they may transform themselves. Obviously, a lot of these high flyers are now, you know, they've gone beyond betting on you know, social media. They bet on the cloud and cloud services, and now they're betting on metaverse and you know, some of the virtual services. Look, perhaps some of these companies will make that transition to, you know, leadership yet again in these emerging markets. But we continue to believe that the next set of market leaders are going to be a different set of six or seven companies if we look, you know, 3 to 5 years from now.
Lisa Shallet of Morgan Stanley Wealth Management. Lisa, wonderful to catch up with you. You know that. We always enjoy it. Thank you. Joining us now is Tony Crescenzi, market strategist and portfolio manager at PIMCO. Tony, great to have you back with us. Let's
morning,
just start
John.
Right here.
Thank you.
So we've got the strongest print we've seen going all the way back to 1982. We've talked a lot about it in the last 24 hours. The question I asked Tom just moments ago, I'll ask it of you. How hard would it be for the Fed to deliver more than what this market is already looking for in 22?
Quite difficult, but you could see the power of communication is one of the chief tools the Fed has. It can use words and then perhaps use action later, so it doesn't have to deliver that action this year necessarily. It could indicate it may have to do more somewhere in the future. And of course, the quantitative tightening, which we see not occurring until September, who knows, could be pulled forward. That's one other tool, and perhaps use that in place of a hike. We're looking for 3 to 4 hikes this year. But Jonathan, one of the key things, stories for the bond market, for the stock market, for the credit markets, markets more broadly, is the market priced for enough in terms of the terminal rate? The markets think the Fed will stop somewhere around 1.75, 2. The Fed thinks neutral is 2.5. So there's a battle out there in the future, potentially,
right,
if the inflation rate stays high and the jobless rate keeps falling, if we reach late cycle dynamics, where the Fed has to tell markets we need to do more, and then that's when there's more trouble.
Let's go to page 942 of your claim book. How far out is a terminal rate given a natural disaster? You can't go out 7 years now. You can't go out 10 years. Right. Is a terminal rate 4th of July?
Well, as you said, Tom, earlier, you've all been talking about the amount of hikes built into this year. You see the comfort level is pretty good right now with the 4 hikes. The stock market, the bond market didn't react to Powell's hawkishness, didn't react to the new highs in the CPI. The market's also priced for 3 hikes in 2023, but then nothing, pretty much. Is that nothing too little? That's the big question.
Okay, but Tony, the money question here, yeah. With great respect to the gazillion dollars that PIMCO manages, are you managing the short-term Tony Crescenzi space for the end of the world? You're all in cash, you're wicked short duration. That's CFA talk, folks. Or are you guys saying, no, the gloom is wrong, and we're going to extend duration to find a coupon and some total return? Which is it?
It's more of the former, but there's a little bit of the latter. A lot of it's the portfolio context. An investor should always have the portfolio in mind, the credit beta, the equity beta, the correlation to the other assets in the portfolio when buying bonds. Think about that idea you just brought up, Tom. In a sense, you said, are you considering market timing? In a portfolio that's balanced, market timing, the diversification benefits of bonds is akin to getting in a car and saying, today I think I'll be safe, I don't need car insurance. Not to say that bonds are insurance, but they do provide some benefit in the case that there's a so-called accident. So we are underweight duration. We do think markets are a bit underpriced for the potential for an increase in the terminal rate from the 1.75 or so that's built into what the Fed thinks is neutral, but it probably would not get much beyond the 2s. And so when looking out on the Bloomberg terminal at the five-year, as they say, where does the market think the 5-year treasury will be in 5 years? Most yields across the yield curve, the term structure as they call it in the books, are around 2%, pretty flat curve, which is a way of saying the Fed will be successful in the long run, and it can move its policy rate up much. So that's what the market's saying. We disagree to an extent, but not a lot.
Tony, in the meantime, we're looking at actual yield, at actual return in cash, at actual return in the short-term space. Do you think that this is going to be one of the best years in a while for people who are keeping their money in that sort of cash-like space?
Yes, because we've had already seen an increase. Look at the two-year Treasury note at 90 basis points. Historically, I would have said, well, when the two-year Treasury gets to 100 basis points over the federal funds rate, that's kind of it for yields in general. There are times, though, when it can be higher than that, even as wide as 200 basis points. So there may be more in terms of yield increases if the market thinks the Fed's actions aren't enough. But stepping outside of what they call the 2A7 world, the regulated world that's for the money market.
Yeah, I stepped outside that last week.
We all do. It's an exciting thing to do, isn't it? Tom, the 2A7 world dictates that money market funds have average maturities of around 60 days, should cap their cap there, and there's limitations on the types of credit. So stepping outside that a little bit can get an investor a little more yield, but they've got to be judicious about it.
Tony, wonderful to catch up. And send our best to the team
who put out
their cyclical outlook this
Thanks,
week
Tom.
As well.
Thanks, Lisa.
A brilliant read. Thank you, Tony. Tony Crescenzi there of PIMCO.
Looking at the many fronts of Russia right now. It used to be simple math. There was one front. There were two fronts. This morning, there are three or four fronts. For Lisa Bramwitz and myself, for all of you on radio and television, a wonderful time to speak to Ambassador Hormats. Robert Hormats is Managing Director at Tiedemann Advisors, but far, far more with his experience from Northern Ireland deep to Kazakhstan as well. Bob, I don't even know where to start. But I guess I'll start with Kazakhstan, because I would suggest that is where Americans are most ignorant. Explain from a diplomacy standpoint the importance for America of Kazakhstan.
Well, Kazakhstan, first of all, is a large supplier and transit vehicle for natural gas and for oil, some of which goes to China, but some of it also, particularly from the Caspian, goes to Western Europe and the West. So second, energy, particularly uranium, where they are, however you measure, between 40 and 60% of the world's uranium production comes from Kazakhstan. And now we're building up nuclear power. They're extremely important. And third is they're very strategically located. Other than Mongolia, which is sort of sandwiched in between Russia and China, they're the only country in the world that has a border with both China and Russia. So the fact that there are Russian troops there for the moment is not worrisome, because they'll probably leave and there's no stability, but they could be another, as you put it, front on the Russian desire to expand its influence.
Bob, what is our diplomatic inertial force forward? China's got a view. Russia's got a view. Our view is an isolationist tone back 250 years, and the idea that Kazakhstan's on the other side of the world. What is the diplomatic oomph that Republicans and Democrats can generate towards this important part of the world?
Very little. In fact, there's a curiosity here, and that is, we don't want, the Russians don't want, the Chinese don't want instability in Kazakhstan for various reasons. And that is, you know, it's on the borders of Russia and China. And if it were unstable, it would be an opportunity for the Russians in particular to expand their influence. But we really have had very good relations with the Kazakhs. I've been there when I was in government several times.
Yeah.
And Nazarbayev tried to play a very clever role between Russia, the U.S., and China. But if it becomes an unstable place and a lot of instability, it affects the world's energy supplies, it affects the world's uranium supplies, and it makes for more political volatility in Central Asia.
Yeah.
It's the biggest country in the region.
Ambassador Hormats, as the whole world moves toward a less fossil fuel intensive energy regime, I do wonder whether the United States has enough of a footprint in some of these countries that provide such a huge proportion of the raw materials needed to engage in some of these plans. What's your view on that at a time when Russia and China are moving together to try to solidify their strategic positioning in that region?
Well, that's a great point, because the Kazakhs really have been suppliers, particularly for American oil companies, of a lot of oil. And, but not all of it comes to the U.S., but it does go to some of our friends and allies, and it affects the world price. So it does matter a lot. In terms of our influence there, from a geopolitical point of view, it's far, far less than the Russians or the Chinese. And therefore, our ability to really play a major role is significant. But we want stability there. The Russians and the Chinese do, too. We don't want it to be used as a base for radical jihadists. I don't think it will be, because right. The Kazakhs don't want that. But it's very important quantitatively on energy and strategically, just because of where it's located and where its neighbors are.
Bob, given your former experience as an ambassador, and given that the vote for the Nord Stream 2 sanctions could come as soon as today in the U.S. Senate, do you think that is a wise move for the United States to move to try to pressure Russia in some of the rhetoric and, frankly, the Ukrainian border?
Well, that's a big problem, and it really requires reading Putin's mind. The question is, if you legislate that now, and the administration's made this point, you're reducing some of their negotiating leverage over the Russians in the future. Sergei Ryabkov and Wendy Sherman, who are both very skilled negotiators, are trying to work things out. If you sort of stick your nose in the Russians' face, even if there's a strategic benefit for the United States to tweaking the Russians and putting pressure on them, it does make the negotiations harder and puts Putin in a much more aggressive mood, because he's saying you're taking unilateral action that's going to adversely affect us and our neighbors. Because don't forget, there's a big difference among the Europeans on this. Some Europeans want Nord Stream 2, some do not. And you have now 30 countries in Western Europe united against Russia and supporting the U.S. For the U.S. To do this unilaterally, I think, would cause division in Europe, which would not help the negotiators.
Robert Hormats, thank you so much. That's all the time we've got for today. Tiedemann Advisors Ambassador Robert Hormats. This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and, of course, on the terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.